Hi, Kuba, and welcome to my podcast.
Hi, hello, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Trying to get warm in the British weather, but it's good, it's good. So I'm really, really excited about talking to you today. And I was just reading a little bit about you, and I saw that you were born in Gdansk. Did I pronounce it well? In Poland?
I was born in Krakow, to be honest.
Oh, right. But you grew up in...
I was born in Krakow, but I only lived there for a year, and then we moved to Gdansk, which is opposite side of Poland, up north, where I grew up. So, yeah, you can, you know, I haven't born there, but that's my city.
You grew
really,
up in there.
Yeah.
Okay. And, well, from the pictures, I see it's a beautiful, beautiful place. But I also read about the fact that the restaurant culture wasn't that popular when you grew up in there. And I kind of see similarities with Moldova because, for example, when I grew up in Moldova, we didn't go out to restaurants. I never remember us going out with my parents to restaurants. But it's good and bad in an interesting way. It's good because, in a way, we learned how to cook everything from scratch, to be self-sufficient, to grow everything. And I think we have this in our blood to have everything made from scratch. And I see that in your cooking. And I wonder if that was what happened for you. Tell me a little bit about growing up there and what sort of influence did that kind of food have for you?
Yeah, you know, I have to agree with what you said about, you know, there is now a blood, or is it blood, or more, you know, the reality where we are living it,
yeah,
that you had to be fairly self-sufficient, or at least sort of exchange the goods with your neighbors and friends, because obviously someone had apples and someone had a cow and someone could fix the Hoover. So, or another lady had a phone on the, you know, floor number three. So obviously that is a lot of it is not done. You know, a lot of people from Western Europe probably don't really understand what we're talking about. but that's what the reality was of 80s and 90s where I more of 80s than 90s when I grew up. But yes, back then in Poland, as you said, you know, I've been, I think, a few times in the restaurant with my parents on holidays or somewhere, but that wasn't really a restaurant. That was sort of going for a home cooked meal to someone else's home almost. You know, I mean, it wasn't a culinary adventure in any way. So, and as well, education, and it was not regarded, you know, in any way, in all fairness. So when I told my parents that when I was, I think, 17, that I think I quite like restaurants and cooking, and I just there's something that sort of attracts me, that they were horrified. They were like, oh, you know, come on, you know, calm down, son. You know, you need to go to university. You need to make a degree, and that's the only way forward, which... people of their era, of their generation, you know, that's you know, for them that was the only way forward, which was probably quite right, because as I said, cooking wise, there was no way for me to do anything about, you know, back then in Poland. And yeah, you know, nowadays, you know, to be honest, I don't think like that when I cook about sort of as much as, you know, about my past and what we did. I think it comes naturally. Mm-hmm. Which, hence, I think the sentence when you said that it's now a blood, I think it's quite right, because, you know, I remember my grandparents, my parents, friends, we all did different, you know, preserves for winter. In the summer, we would pick lots of cherries and put them in the jars for, you know, make compotes and stuff for winter and jams and so on. So you had to do it. You know, if you didn't do it, you didn't have it. So, so I think... I think there's no doubt that some of this, you know, came to my cooking, but only for the last sort of 3 or 4 years, I think, you know, maybe five, because, you know, first 10 years, let's say, of cooking, where I've trained, I came to UK, I went to college, then working with Raymond Blanc in Le Manoir, or Quatre Saisons. It was all French cooking, classic, and I've you know, I haven't used any of my Polish sort of heritage in there, because, you know, I have to learn my craft. But I think recently I've discovered that, you know, there is so much exciting stuff in Polish cuisine or Eastern European cuisine, and there's so much skill involved, and all these very old techniques which, you know, my grandparents and so on could do, and they used to do it on an everyday basis. And I just felt that excites me. Plus, I just think that nowadays we kind of forget, you know, we're all into technology, and, you know, this the same with this in the cooking. You know, you got all this amazing equipment which you just press the button and put the probe and it will does anything for you and so on. And it's great, but I've just felt like, you know, I won't carry on that sort of heritage, and I want to have that skill and be able to sort of show it to people and preserve it for the future.
Mm-hmm. So I totally relate about the part you were saying about your parents wanting you to do a certain degree, because the same happened to me. I was telling them I want to do art before I turned 18, and they were saying you should take a career that will bring you money, basically. So I totally relate to that. And I've been in office jobs, and I don't think it's suited me personally. And I know it was a bit similar for you as well. You realized office job is not for you. And then, so I totally get that. And I'm interested to know, how was your experience in Sydney as well? Because this is when you realize that you actually really love being in a kitchen, isn't it?
Yeah, Sydney, you know, I went to Australia when I was 20. In between universities, I went to one uni, technical uni, to study to mechanics, but after a month, I think I felt like, oh, you know, it was hard as well, hard course. And I was like, no, even if I survive a year, there's no way I will, you know, finish it. So I just quit. So I almost had like a gap year. So I thought, well, let's do something. And I have opportunity, and with the help of my parents, and I went to Sydney to study English mainly, but while I was there, I got the job because as on being on student visa, I could work and start working as a kitchen porter in an Italian restaurant, which was an open kitchen restaurant. So and my pot wash was as well in the open space. So I was sort of on one line with chefs, you know, on the left hand side, there were chefs cooking and all the flambéing and, you know, all the action of the kitchen. And it was, you know, don't get me wrong, it was a massively hard work, like many hours standing in water, my skin was peeling off, and it was hard. But then for whatever reason, I've just felt, you know, fell in love in this, and I just felt like, you know, this is, you know, I love it. I love this atmosphere. I love this buzz. I love this adrenaline. Yeah, you know, even they used to do pesto every day, like massive buckets of fresh basil pesto. Mm. And I've never seen fresh basil, to be honest, before in Poland, or not, maybe, you know, on a few occasions, but not really. And that smell of that pesto, I remember till today, you know, it's just, I think that's when I close my eyes, that's why it's like, what, you know, I can hear the noise of clinking pans and smell of pesto. So I think, yeah, that was the moment where I felt, you know, I don't know how I'm going to do it. Because obviously back then I still didn't have a clue how could I do it, and I didn't know what that mean. But I think, yeah, that was a turning point where I don't think so. I realized that a few years ago, but on that point I didn't realize that. But I think that was the turning point where you know, where I kind of knew that somehow in the next few years I need to find the way to get there.
Mm-hmm. So then you met Magda and moved to the UK and went to study on what is now called East Kent College. I think it was called differently before.
Fannett College.
Mm-hmm. And I was reading that because you were older than your colleagues, that made you be more serious about it, and you really put a lot of effort into learning a lot. I imagine you're like a sponge, learning about everything and trying your
best.
Well,
again, I was 24. You know, the guys were 16. I was 24. I've just finished my degree in financial management. You know, I've been in Australia twice. I've been traveling, you know, around Europe, backpacking and all sorts, because, you know, I did a lot of traveling. So, you know, my life experience was completely different as well. But most of all, you know, I mean, when I came to the college, the first day I was just like amazed, and I couldn't believe that you know, the facilities over there, the supplies, the course, the, you know, it was like 5 days from, you know, because I did every course possible I've spent, you know, I mean, I was there from early, you know, first minute I could be there to the last minute doing, you know, different classes, different things, because I was just, yeah, you know, it was like a dream come true, you know what I mean, which I didn't even know something like this exists. On top of it was free, you know, it was okay. I only paid some money, which was really for cover my lunches in the canteen. So, you know, I just couldn't believe it.
I imagine at that point you already knew what you wanted as well, in comparison to your colleagues who were quite young and inexperienced. Probably they weren't sure that they want to be there in the first place.
Exactly. You know, I mean, I knew as well that, you know, okay, I'm 24 now, and I've already changed the direction, you know, from financial management and whatever, which, you know, always was, you know, I did financial, you know, I did, as I said, I wanted mechanics, but that was too hard. Financial management was easy enough that I could be there. I finished my degree, but I didn't have to put too much effort into it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't really what I wanted to do from day one, in all fairness. It was extended, you know, I still enjoyed it. I think it was good to do. You know, I've extended my youth. I was younger for longer. And as I said, I could travel a lot. I've met a lot of people. So it was a great time. But, you know, I felt, okay, now I'm 24. And, you know, it's time to get serious, you know, because time is going. So, yeah, I think that's, as you said, you know, I mean, I was already focused and excited. And, you know, I just loved every minute of it.
And also with the financial management, I suppose it will help you in your restaurant as well. You'll have a better understanding of how the financial bit is working in your restaurant.
Yeah,
so that,
sure, you know,
that should be useful as well.
Yeah. It's one of those things again where at the time I was really like, oh, it's a waste of time. And, you know, I didn't really, you know, I enjoyed the company of my friends in the uni and the uni, you know, student life, but didn't really enjoy the course that much. So I was a bit like, oh, you know, a bit of a waste of time. But again, like a lot of things in life, you realize and you back to your life, you know, you're looking back and you just think, oh, actually,
everything was for a reason.
There's a lot of useful information there. So
yeah, I know, because I did business administration for the same reason. I did that degree for my parents, and I was thinking as well, I wasn't interested in the course. I was studying it, but I wasn't too interested in it. And I loved the student life, as you say. But now when I look back, I'm thinking, well, at least I learned some things and some skills. And then even if I had those office jobs after, I can take some of those skills that I developed and use them in what I'm trying to build now with my art and podcast and everything. So, yeah, I think we can take information from everything that we did. Now I'm really interested, and I'm sure you get this question a lot. How was your experience at the Buckingham Palace?
No, that was, you know, that's another amazing sort of story or a chapter of the whole story. It's surreal, you know, that's mm-hmm. I think that's words, because again, first time I went there, what, 2006, I think. So I came to UK in 2004 or 2005, even maybe I went for the first time. So anyway, basically, you know, I remember being in this massive ballroom in Buckingham Palace where, you know, it was a state visit of, I don't know, you know, King of Norway or President of China or someone like that, with the top table, you know, Queen, Tony Blair and who the guest and all the sort of, you know, people from politics, which he kind of knew and so on. And the massive band on the balcony, I dressed up in all this sort of fancy clothes and with a big golden salver. And I remember standing there and just like, you know, my Lord, you know, I mean, 3 years ago, I was a bit of a hippie during university, you know, I was, so like three years ago, I was running you know, on Samothraki beach, that's island in Greece, you know, listen to a trance music and on a week's festival in the Hawaiian shirt and long hair, and now I'm here, you know what I mean, in the palace in the middle of London. So I think that was very, very surreal, you know. But no, amazing experience, because obviously I've seen what was nice as well. That was Buckingham Palace and Windsor Castle, that, you know, you could see the buildings itself from different perspective, you know, the places, the rooms that you would never be able to see even if you go as a tourist. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I didn't serve or talk to royal family, but I've been, you know, meters of meters from the Queen or Prince Charles or Philip and so on. So that was, you know, obviously very exciting. And a lot of people from, you know, movies and famous people, which you'd know from Poland, from, you know, James Bond movies and so on, and politicians. And so, yeah, all in all, it was obviously a very, very surreal and exciting time.
Okay, and now I'm going to ask you something that you don't have to answer if you don't want to. So I see it as a great opportunity for you, obviously, but I also see from what you're cooking now, at least, that probably it was a great experience, but it wasn't the style that suited you for food-wise. And I might be wrong in saying this. But, and again, you don't have to answer this, but it's just a curiosity of mine.
What the food style you mean in Buckingham Palace?
Yeah. I think that you have probably more freedom of creating stuff after. I don't know if I'm perceiving all this wrong.
It's, you know, it's very old fashioned and, you know, typical British cuisine and it's all very, you know, very, you know, upper class, you know what I mean, with everything. So very, very, you know, lots of rules and, you know, and strict measurements with a ruler and this and the other, you know, it's all very precise.
Yeah. That's what I'm interested in. Did you have room for creativity in there, or everything was very strict and
precise? Oh, obviously not. You know, not on the level I was. You know, I mean, that's for sure not. But mm-hmm. I work in, you know, for Raymond Blanc into Michelin star restaurant. I was kind of the same. You know,
okay,
especially in the early stages. Later on, there was a few things like, you know, maybe canapes or something where I was allowed to sort of. You know, I remember coming to a chef and, you know, when, oh, chef, you know, what do you think about that? And then and a few things kind of came to the menu. But again, that would be little things because mm-hmm. obviously in the places like that, they you know, it's a history and dishes are almost set and they are the creative people, you know, in different positions. You don't have time to be creative anyway because you work 16 hours a day plus because you go, you know, and you have to do what they tell you to do. So in general, I think the early days of cooking career are there for just hard graft and not so much for creativity.
Yeah.
But on and all, you know, I mean, looking at the Buckingham Palace and, you know, I work in British Embassy in Paris and obviously Le Manoir, which is, you know, a very sort of, you know, as well, you know, 2-star Michelin restaurant. Well, so everything is very, very... high level and precise and so on. I think, you know, more and more now I and what I'm cooking now and what I want to cook and how I would like to my restaurant to be is more to be like I am, which means free, you know, and very obviously high quality, but honest. So, you know, it's mm-hmm. not about, you know, I don't want to sell too many stories because I think food a lot of time, especially on the higher level, it's a lot, you know, it's marketing around it.
Mm-hmm.
As such, you know, I mean, you know, if you, you know, a piece of meat, it can be, it's still a piece of meat, but if you add, it's like anything in life, you know, if you add to it a big marketing, it always, you know, will look better.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want focus on the food, focus on giving customers food and at the honest price, whatever it's honest, obviously for to business to work, but without too many of, you know, I mean, sort of, what's the word? To cut on the fluff, you know. I don't know if you understand what I mean. You know, I I'm a straight guy. You know, I mean, I like being straight, and I like
No formalities around it.
Well, for me, wine, you know, for us, like wine and stuff. You know, I mean, wine is great, but you know, you can the wine world, for example, it's, you know, sometimes when you listen to the sommeliers and stories, and I just find it too deep and too long and too long-winded. And very often I find a lot of it is just a story, which is kind of very exaggerated just to make it, you know, I mean, sound great. But in the end of the day, it's wine. And obviously some wine lovers might now be, you know, offended. But you know, for me, you know, I like wine or I don't like wine. If it's nice, it's nice. If it's not, it's not. And then obviously, it's interesting sometimes, obviously, the individual people, what effort they go and producer, and that's fine. But I don't like when it's too much of that. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. For me, it's either white wine or red wine. And I choose red wine. It needs to be a dry red wine. I don't care about any other things.
Yeah, you know,
if it's a dry red wine, I like it.
I don't want to be so bland about it, but it is kind of like that, you know, for me. You know, I mean, it's sort of, and that, you know, maybe because I don't understand wine, maybe, I don't know. I don't have a big knowledge about wine, for example. So maybe, you know, maybe that's the reason. But I just sometimes find that, you know, I mean, all this sort of, yeah, it's a marketing, you know, well, that's what I'm trying to say. It's kind of adding to you know, and maybe that adds to experience, and some people like this, you know, and they that's why those restaurants are very, you know, popular, and people you know, go there for that full experience of that stories and that knowledge. But for me, food and eating and drinking is more, you know, to relax and just be with your friends. And mm-hmm. obviously food for me is important because I'm a chef, but I still think that, in all fairness, I think I had a better experience, food experiences in the places where the atmosphere and the people I was with were was great. And I don't sometimes even remember where I was eating. And the places where you go with high expectation and you just, that, you know, you look at every single dish and you dissect it and you look from left and right. Very often, all this focus kind of takes away from experience. And then I just realized, actually, I'm not, you know, food was good, but I don't think so. I've enjoyed the experience as a whole, mm-hmm. because, you know, I mean, I think food is about people. Mm-hmm.
So what you said about wine made me curious about the smallest restaurant in the UK or possibly in the world that you opened, because I know you're going to soon open your own restaurant, which is the second your own restaurant, but you had one in your backyard. And I was reading that you actually didn't serve wine, you had to bring your own. Was that the reason why? Because people can just bring what they like, or was
mainly is the license, the alcohol license is mm-hmm. the main thing. I obviously don't have alcohol license, but again, that experience, you know, the smallest restaurant in the world, blah, blah. It's a bit of a marketing bit, you know, I mean, it was always my development kitchen and testing ground, you know, for the future project, and something which kept me in the social media space and so on. And actually it went much better than I've expected, but it was mainly a marketing tool and a research tool. And yes, alcohol I couldn't sell, so hence I asked people to bring it. But that as well kind of opened, you know, certain eyes for me that, you know, you talk to people and obviously, you know, running a restaurant, you know, you need to make money, and wine is one of those things you make money on. But I can feel like people are very often kind of, you know, like they feel that the wine is too expensive in restaurants, you know, and you know, people, especially when they know their wine, you know, they know that bottle in the shop costs £20 and on the menu is for 100, mm-hmm. and they feel very, you know, that's quite not fair. And that kind of, you know, one of this point makes me realize that I need to find a way to obviously make money because I need to run a business, but as well,
think about the customers,
think about how can I make it so so it's fair, you know, fair mm-hmm. for everybody, but as well more accessible for everybody, but as well you don't have that feeling of being ripped off, realistically.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'll just talk to you a little bit more about your experience, and then I want to go on after to talk about products themselves. But so you said, you already said that you had the classical training when you worked for Michel Roux and when you worked for Raymond Blanc, and then you went on, I think you worked for about 10 years at the Feathered Nest Country Inn, and you succeeded to put that place on a map, basically, because you developed it. And I mean, you tell me more about it. I know you entered the competition as well, and you won the competition, which was called, I wrote it somewhere.
National Chef of the Year.
That one, in 2019. Yes, so tell me more about that. What changes did you bring to the restaurant?
Well, I mean, restaurant, you know, we built a restaurant from scratch, and so it wasn't really a matter of bringing changes. It was a new... you know, didn't exist before, so we start from nothing. I was a sous chef for first year and a half, mm-hmm. And then I took it over. So I was a head chef there for about seven and a half years. You know, the Feathered Nest was an amazing chapter. It was something I needed because obviously, you know, I started late. I was 24 when I came to UK, went to college, 27 when I finished college. So 27, I had my first proper, okay, I did work throughout the college, but 27 was my first proper full-time kitchen job in Le Manoir. Then I was 30 when I finished. So I was, you know, already quite, you know, people age 30 in the kitchens, they usually got around 14 years experience. I had 3. Mm-hmm. So obviously 3 plus college, so, you know, let's say, you know, touching 6. So obviously, yeah, there was a lot of to catch up and a lot to learn. And the Feathered Nest, it ended up being this great place where, after I became head chef, my, the owners, Tony and Amanda, which owned it, they allowed me to grow. They invested in me, and I could, so the place kind of grew with me. So we started with, sort of as a pub. We had sort of, obviously maybe as well with the head chefs, which were the, you know, head chef, which was to start with, but we kind of started like a pub, you know, fish and chips with some burgers, some a la carte dishes, but it was sort of a gastropub or something like that. So, and then, you know, year on year, which, you know, where I was gaining more and more experience, more and more knowledge, and I was always pushing myself and exploring different things and teaching myself new techniques, reading books, and you know, so the place was kind of, it gave me this platform and opportunity to grow, and they were patient and they were happy to support this. So We from a pub kind of thing, we evolved into that. It was more a fine dining restaurant or a restaurant, but with rooms where, I think food was great, and it was a completely different experience than to start with, for sure. But over there, sort of, you know, I mean, after first few years as a head chef, obviously I was a bit, you know, I didn't know much, so I was a bit like Raymond Blanc, but of like other chefs looking in the books, you know, I was more a kind of a copycat almost, or changing bits from other people, but, you know, obviously I didn't really know who I was as a chef back then yet, and which is a normal stage, I think.
Yeah.
But then in a second phase, I was kind of, you know, went more into curing and smoking and exploring the power, you know, sort of my heritage, and that was more and more present on the menu, and my style was kind of developing, and who I am as a chef, which was great. And then, yes, so one part, another part of my development, and it was more about sort of look, because obviously being in the Cotswolds in a small tiny village and being from Poland,
as well. It's quite hard to put yourself on a scene of or in you know gastronomic scene of UK and in industry. So I was looking into ways how could I do it. We're quite lucky with James Martin, which you know he because I was on Saturday's Kitchen in 2015 for the first time, where because James Martin came around to the Feathered Nest, he really liked it, so you know he came a few times, invited me anyway. But he was the first of my breaks in a way to get a little bit more nationwide. Mm-hmm. And then I felt, well, you know, what can I do to sort of put myself a bit more on the map? And then the competition of National Chef of the Year, which is a sort of the most prestigious industry-based competition in the UK, judged by, you know, the all top chefs in the UK. So, and I felt, well, you know, maybe let's give this a try. And took me a few years, to be honest, to get sort of enough courage to finally do it. First year I was straight into final, which was, you know, great achievement. Didn't win. So next, you know, year after I entered again, and I've managed to win, which was amazing, because yeah, it exactly did what I wanted to do. It put me on a map of, you know, sort of British gastronomy, and as well, most importantly, you know, I've met so many people, from chefs to people working in other sort of industries connected with food, and the network, it's, you know, it's incredible. Title is one thing, and that was obviously a personal, very, very nice personal thing. But I think what came with it, you know, I didn't even expect it, to be honest. So for sure, it was a great, great move.
That sounds amazing. So I would like to talk about actual products at the moment, or at least the way you preserve them. And I would like to start with pickles. So, for example, in Moldova, we do most of our pickling in salt and water, and only a few in vinegar. And when I came to the UK, I could only find gherkins, for example, in vinegar. And I was just, you know, desperate to find something pickled in salt. And now I ended up making, because, yeah, you can find sauerkraut in the shops. But except if you go, you know, to Russian, Polish shops where you can find pickles as I like them. But I started making my own sauerkraut. So my question for you is, first, how do you pickle and what do you pickle? And if you have any particular way that you do your own sauerkraut?
I mean, we need to differentiate. First of all, say, you know, you say pickle with salt. Pickle with salt means fermenting, really. So pickle is always... pickle is always with vinegar, and we use brine, which is a water and salt solution. You would call it fermentation, because that's what happens to, obviously, to, you know, if you put cabbage, you know, it's a fermented cabbage, so it's not pickled. You would use vinegar for that. So, of course, you know, being from Poland as well, most of the things were fermented. There was some pickled stuff as well. You know, I remember pickled peppers and pickled, you know, little courgettes and stuff. But yes, you know, cucumbers, sauerkraut, and anything like that would be mostly fermented. I do quite a bit. You know, I mean, sort of nothing crazy, because as well, sometimes I feel like, because obviously it's quite fashionable, especially in the UK now, all the fermented food, and there's a lot of places where, you know, you read through the menu and everything is fermented, and just almost feel like, well, is there any fresh food on the menu? Mm-hmm. Where, you know, obviously where I'm from, and then yourself, and the buttermilks and kefirs and dairy products or vegetable fermentation was, you know, it wasn't fashion, it was just the things you did for centuries to preserve food for winter. And and as well, obviously, we didn't have, okay, maybe in Moldova, I don't know, but in Poland, we didn't have lemons and citrus fruit and oranges that much. So, and the sauerkrauts and sour cucumbers and stuff were amazing. Where, you know, the source of vitamin C and a good health, you know, bacteria, gut bacteria stuff. So sauerkraut, yeah, I do, you know, I do normal traditional sort of shredded one. I do as well the whole head one or whole leaves, you know, depends if I want to do, you know, some like you've seen on a
probably James, you know, Martin.
James Martin, yeah. So that's sort of different, you know, that sort of sort of thing. I like it quite plain. We traditionally we always grate a bit of carrot, so I usually do cabbage and carrot if it's sort of grated one. Mm-hmm. I like caraway seed into it, so a bit of caraway seed and bay leaf, and then just water solution with, you know, with salt. So and I like it quite. I don't like it when it's sort of too fermented and it becomes sort of soft and mushy. I quite like it sort of sour but still crunchy, so almost like a sour Koslo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, the next thing that I want to talk to you about is game meat, because you're generally passionate about cured meat in general, but I want to talk particularly about this as so Mark, my boyfriend, really really loves cooking, and he always tells me how good game meat is because it's more healthy, has less fat, it's more tasty, more flavor, and so on. Tell me about it, how much do you use it? Because I think you started introducing it more, as in the UK it wasn't consumed as much, or you tell me if I understood this correctly.
I mean, game in the UK is big, and is, I think, you know, again, Poland is quite big for hunting as well, but it's kind of actually the same situation, because obviously, you know, it's both obviously Poland, lots of forests, and there's, you know, there is a lot of hunting going on, and same as in England, but when you look on the supermarket shelves or in the mainstream food chain, there's no game exists almost. So and it's both countries the same, which for whatever reason. I love game. I think I learned more about game in UK than I didn't have much connection with game back home. Mm-hmm. Mainly because you couldn't really get a mainstream in the cities. In UK, obviously living in the Cotswolds in the countryside, where there's a lot of shoots going on and a lot of stuff like this, and the access to the great game is the phone call there, but
that's okay.
The access to the game is great, and again, that was something I have to learn how to do, but I quickly discovered, as you rightly said, that the meat is delicious. You know, there was always this myth of game being very sort of strong and quiet taste, which it can be if it's, you know, obviously hung for very long and matured. But all in all, yes, you know, I mean, they're coming back to the feathered nest time, especially in the game season, which sort of starts, grouse starts in August, and sort of September, a few things, and fully on from 1st of October till the end of January, all my meat was game, purely because of the location, but as well, yeah, I just love the flavor, and yeah, you know, there's a lot of people which are against hunting and against, you know, all this sort of animal stuff, but I just think, you know, there's the population needs to be regulated, and there's no, obviously there's, you know, too many deers at times and too many other things, species, because there's not many predators in yeah, you know, in the wild in the UK and stuff. So,
and then farmers, the deers eat the trees, and then it's not environmentally
friendly. Farmers and stuff, they kill it anyway. So I think, you know, if that happens, okay, certain commercial shoots for pheasants and grouse and this, okay, that's something I could maybe question, because obviously, yeah, it's a sport as well, which maybe that's not that great, but on and all, I think we all should eat more game, because it's, yeah, as you said, healthy, delicious, less in fat, good in protein, and yeah, you know, it's just wild food.
Great. The next point that I want to talk to you about is mushrooms. So when we went with the motorhome in Poland and we stayed in the woods because I mean, the nature in Poland is absolutely amazing. But we did notice that a lot of people were picking up mushrooms. And so then Mark learned, because I think Seps, the ones that you cooked on James Martin's show as well, they are the easiest mushrooms to pick without having knowledge in general about mushrooms. So I wonder if, is it something typical that you do foraging in Poland? And then I know you do foraging in the UK as well. And yeah, tell me more about mushrooms.
Well, Poland, you know, in Poland, picking mushrooms, it's a family thing. You know, everyone does it, you know, realistically. So it's a national thing, you know, starts already in sort of August time. First mushrooms popping, it depends obviously on the weather, but first mushroom popping out. And then throughout September and October, a bit of October as well, depends, on the weather. You go and you know, you wake up early in the morning, you prepare all this sort of picnic with you and food and some boiled eggs, remember, and go very early, you know, sort of, so you before other people, because obviously there's always whoever is first got the best crop. Mm-hmm. Whole families goes, you pick, you then later on you go back home with all these mushrooms. They need to be all cleaned, and some are dried, because our Christmas Eve dinner usually there's option of borscht or wild mushroom soup. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of pierogi, and there's a lot of dishes which include mushrooms, so traditionally they will be dried. You know, you put them on the fret and you know, do like a necklaces of mushrooms, and then some of them would be eaten straight away with scrambled eggs or you know, or some other dishes with potatoes and sour cream. And some could be frozen. So, but obviously there's a lot of mushrooms, so the whole family go pick them, and the whole family later on sort of preps them and preserve them for the, you know, for the months to come. Mm-hmm. But in general, we're quite foraging, you know, we forage quite a bit, you know, because obviously, you know, things like bilberries and wild strawberries and chanterelle mushrooms, a bit more, they're more in the summer. We always, you know, every summer you if you go camping or go on holiday anywhere, you'd go in the woods and pick stuff. So
And you just learn from your family which types of mushrooms are good.
In UK is a bit, you know, the Poland's a bit different than UK in the way of what you pick. In UK they pick a lot of other, I've learned, you know, a lot of other types of mushrooms in UK, mm-hmm. in the kitchens, which I never knew before, because in Poland there's a sort of certain type everyone pick, and certainly don't, like, you know, black trumpets mushroom, for example. I only seen them in UK, and once I found them not far away from my home in Poland, like whole field of it, and none of my family wanted to touch it, because they were like, oh, what's this? And I said, oh, they're good mushrooms. But but you learn from, obviously, yes, you know, you learn from your family, and you know, the good rule is, first of all, to, if you're not quite sure, just don't take it, you know what I mean, simple as that, you know what I mean, don't be too greedy.
Oh, sounds amazing. I don't know if you want to talk about other types of mushrooms as well, or you're just joking about it.
That's my hippie life, you know what I mean? That's past. But we used to pick them as well, yes.
What about truffles? I mean, I know you need a pig or a dog for that, but...
No, truffles obviously is more like Italian and the south of France things, you know what I mean? We, you know, there was no truffles. I've never had at least truffles from Poland, so...
Okay.
So truffle was never... And, I mean, nice truffle is nice truffle, okay? You know, I mean, there's some... Especially the winter black truffles, you know, or white truffle. Yeah, they can be nice. But on and all, I don't want to offend any Italian friends or someone, but sometimes I feel they, again, a little bit overrated, and they kind of, you know, in that world
overpriced.
Of, you know what I mean? Yeah, you know what I mean? For, you know, I think, yeah, if you got white truffles, you know what I mean? 2,000-3,000 pounds a kilo, you know, so you got, you know, each slice is, you know, £5 or £10, whatever, you know, it's a bit extreme, I think, for what I think is more excitement that they, you know, it's more excitement about how expensive they are than how much they, how they taste.
Mm-hmm. My last question, because I'm taking too much of your time, I think, already, although it's so nice to talk to you. I could just talk for ages with you. So I know you are working with the Polish embassy to promote Poland in the UK. I'm wondering if you have any plans to maybe open something in Poland, for example, and if you see in general a development in the food industry in Poland.
There's no plans to open anything in Poland. I have no plans to go back to Poland, in all fairness. You know, maybe, okay, you never say never, you know, maybe, yeah, you know, sort of some sort of retirement or you know, okay, my son is 11. He's English, realistically, in all fairness. He was born in the UK and he's more English than Polish. So for sure, till he's not independent, we're not going back anywhere. And I think you need to focus. You know, I'm this kind of person. You know, I have a focus on. You know, my dream is not to have, you know, 10 different places everywhere. It's just, you know, I want the one place where I can, you know, where I can be there and people can come to me, because I think that's as well part of experience. You know, there's a lot of places where chefs put the names, but they're never there or very rarely. And I think customers like that sort of, you know, see you. And I think what I do is it's nice to sort of to talk to them and show them firsthand. So no, so nothing been planned in Poland. Although of course, yeah, you know, the scene is growing, and last sort of, I don't know, 7-10 years, it's massive. You know, it's obviously a lot of. A lot of cities have, you know, developed, and a lot of hotels have been built and restaurants, a lot of tourists coming to Poland. So, and as well, Polish people itself, they've traveled quite a lot and been abroad and go abroad. And so demand is bigger and bigger. So no doubt it's a growing market. But yeah, you know, I like my life in the UK. I like countryside and I like, you know, what I got here. And yeah, for now I'm focusing where I am.
Yes, that makes perfect sense. And I wish you best of luck with the opening of your new restaurant and a lot of customers. Obviously, at the moment, there are probably rules in place. You can't have a lot of them in the same time. But I wish you a lot of success with this restaurant, and I'm sure you will have.
Yeah, you know, scary times. It's all sort of... yeah, it's all strange, you know. Strange, yeah, you know. Sort of, I'm home since sort of March. I do bits and bobs and there and there, and but it's kind of, yeah, it's a funny time, and exciting on one hand, but obviously it's
more extra stress.
I'm putting everything on the line, and you know, realistically now, and it is obviously fairly stressful. And but I can't wait, to be honest.
Oh, best of luck, and thank you so much for all this time that you gave for this interview.
No problem. Anytime.